are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, February 6, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Corey Bretschneider, author of The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. Also on the program today, well, not a lot. We did a full... We did a full coverage of the State of the Union last night.
Donald Trump's an asshole.
And...
the truth
is, we're recording this last night. And we've been drinking all night, and we just it took too much out of us, folks. I'm not going to lie to you. And so on the program today, we're going to play that interview from Corey Bretschneider, and we'll be back with the live show on Thursday. However, we'll look back on last night. There were three major speeches. Donald Trump, where he, I think, very effectively made the case that he's not a Holocaust denier. And then we heard from Stacey Abrams, who I think, you know, showed that she's incredibly charismatic. And
excellent. She ran for Senate or for governor again.
Able to pull off the rebuttal to the State of the Union, which is sort of notoriously problematic. And then Bernie Sanders gave a, like, I guess his traditional rebuttal. He's done this for two or three years now. His was not televised. It was just streamed on one of his sites. And I mean, I think on balance, it went a little long, but towards the end, he brought it home very strongly. He went directly at Trump. He obviously congratulated Stacey Abrams. And then also
talked very strongly on the drug war. He added some new elements, voting rights, integrated them. I thought it maybe was a bit long, but it was very good.
And of course, Amy Klobuchar, sort of pre-announced at, in the middle of Trump's speech, or no, I guess it was, God bless you, Matt. I don't know if it was at 8 PM. I think that was Eastern. She announced that she's making a big announcement on Sunday. I don't know for sure that she's going to be.
Maybe she's retiring from the Senate.
It's either she's going to retire from the Senate or she's going to run for president.
So, I have to say, if she does, I will need to amend something, which is I have predicted that Christian Gillibrand was my first, I should have stipulated, main or major Democratic primary candidate. I thought she would be the first to drop out. If Amy Klobuchar declares, I amend that, Amy Klobuchar will be the first to drop out.
Well, that's too late because Richard Ojeda already.
No, but I didn't consider
of the top,
not
of the
to
top,
insult him. I
top
like him.
Tier.
Yes, but I did not consider him to be a top tier contender.
Okay, fair enough.
Yes.
Or at least in terms of, you could just also narrow it down to sitting senators.
Sure.
Because there's going to be a half dozen.
I'm going to go with Booker in that scenario then.
Hmm. That's a respectable choice.
Wow.
Booker's out after Iowa.
What happened to my soundboard?
Wait, Booker is... You say Booker out before Gillibrand. You know what? I will bet you Chinese lunch on that.
That sounds great.
All right.
I'm not sure why it had to be Chinese, but... Folks, speaking of lunch...
Because I want it, because I'm drunk. Sorry,
so
restart the app.
Jenna Andrea Bocelli.
The other day, we had in studio... a crew of folks who were coming, it must have been Friday, where they were here to, or maybe it was Thursday, to because they were coming to see the Michael Brooks show on Friday, including Jeff from Georgia. And we got a delivery from Sherry's Berries. Now, Jamie went home with the flowers. How did the flowers look? Thumbs up. What do we got? Double thumbs up. Also, we had the strawberry dipped in chocolate. And you can never go wrong with Sherrod's Berries, signature dipped Valentine strawberries, dipped in milk, dark, or white chocolatey goodness for any discerning palate. I think they sent us like a half a dozen. I was like, I can have one, but then you guys have to eat this. And it was literally, it was dangerous how quickly everybody went after these.
I wish I had more.
Topped with decadent chocolate chips, heart, and glitter sprinkles, your Valentine will fall in love with every bite. These are the perfect companion to a candlelit dinner, a bouquet of flowers, a night on the town. They ship anywhere nationally, and they always arrive fresh with 100% Sherry Berries guarantee. Valentine's Day right around the corner. Send your Valentine the gift of their dreams at the price of your dreams, starting at just $19.99 plus shipping and handling. Order now. Make this Valentine's Day really special by adding a dozen red roses for just $19.99 more. Berries at no extra charge. Go to berries.com, click on the microphone, enter my code CEDAR, that's SEDER, at checkout. That's berries.com, BERRIES.com. Click on the microphone, enter the code CEDAR, order today. And also, folks, if you're like me and you own a small business, then you've got to be frustrated by dealing with the back-and-forth emails, the endless paperwork. And in our instance, actually, we get paid because, you know, our people sign up for our members. But most small businesses, they bill. And getting paid is always a pain in the neck. HoneyBook can help you spend less time handling the administrative work and more time doing what you love. HoneyBook is an all-in-one business management platform for creative small businesses. HoneyBook makes it easy to streamline your process with client and calendar management tools and custom-branded brochures, proposals, and contracts. You can even get e-signatures, generate invoices, get paid faster, all with one online system. Over 75,000 photographers, designers, event professionals, other solo entrepreneurs have saved hundreds, if not thousands, of hours a year with HoneyBook. The advantages of owning your own business are that generally, like, you don't have to spend a lot of time doing a lot of BS. And HoneyBook makes that a reality. And that's why we've partnered with HoneyBook.com to offer Majority Report listeners 50% off the first year of HoneyBook with the promo code MAJORITY. So get started at HoneyBook.com today. Use the promo code MAJORITY for 50% off your first year. Again, that's HoneyBook.com, promo code MAJORITY. We're going to get to, in a second, a couple of clips from Trump last night. There were a couple moments that we laughed about for an extended period of time. But before we do, just want to remind you that the New Yorker magazine represents the best writing in America today. I mean, this seems obvious, I think, to most people. We've had... this show has relied, frankly, on the New Yorker for a multitude of its guests and the stuff
also
that we talk about.
Just general research.
And general research. Both online and in print, the New Yorker covers a full range of topics, including politics, news, international affairs, climate change, popular culture, the arts, fiction, food, humor, and cartoons. Not to mention, the New Yorker touches on subjects that many readers may not have previously put much thought into, like the world's diminishing supply of sand, paper jams, stink bugs, and hunting down heirloom beans. Some of the New Yorker's incredible writers include contributors like Ronan Farrow. How much has Ronan Farrow, in the stuff that he has reported in the New Yorker, changed our culture over the past year? I mean, it's stunning. He did the pieces on Harvey Weinstein, on Les Moonves, and frankly, he's impacted things based upon the pieces he hasn't done. You got Helen Rossner, James Beard award-winning food writer who contributes essays and reports stories on all things gastronomic. You get across the board a full range of stuff. Every week, I am looking at the New Yorker for stories that we're going to talk about on this program. I am looking for folks to interview. I have been reading The New Yorker, I guess maybe in magazine form or in print for probably, I don't know, 30 years? I still reference articles I read in The New Yorker, like I think over 25 years ago. There was one about acquired narcissism that
this
I read.
This is true.
Atul Gawande wrote about two, for the life of me, I think that article may have been 20 years ago. But they, he wrote about two towns and compared them in terms of Medicare. I mean, The New Yorker writes stuff that lasts lasts the test of time.
Jane Mayer,
of course. Now our listeners can save 50% and get 12 weeks of The New Yorker for just $6. Take it easy, Matt.
Just take the deal.
You go to NewYorker.com/majority and enter the code majority. You'll get an exclusive tote as well as unlimited access to New Yorker's apps, online archives, crossword puzzle, and NewYorker.com with 10 to 15 exclusive site-only stories every day. I don't even know why they throw that in. You don't need it. It's NewYorker.com/majority. Enter the coupon code majority. That's NewYorker.com/majority. Enter majority. All right. So we got two clips that we're going to play from Trump last night that, I mean, broadly speaking, the speech was completely uninspired. He was reading. Look, they all read off a teleprompter, but he didn't seem to have any relationship to the words. It's hard to believe, even in the really sort of saccharine sweet stuff, like the Apollo 11 is what stuck out for me.
The Apollo 11 astronauts?
He didn't realize that he was talking about Apollo 11.
I thought it was 13. I don't know. I can't remember.
But he thought it was.
How many of them?
They went up on the Apollo. 11 astronauts.
Survived.
And
of the 13.
The only time he became animated when he was talking about the half a dozen stories that exist of undocumented immigrants killing people. And, of course, we have far more stories of native-born Americans killing people, but that's not his jam, as the kids would say. This part was sort of fascinating. Which one is this, Matt?
This is the peace and legislation.
Okay, yeah. This was great. I think it's probably unprecedented that we have a State of the Union where the president basically says, please stop investigating.
Even Bill Clinton, I was just like, and you know, while we're at it, you should really stop investigating me constantly. It's totally unfair.
Wait, let's play this first, and then we'll make those jokes. This is Donald Trump's, if the glove doesn't fit, you must acquit moment.
If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
People, that's
the
first of all.
You know, we were talking so much nonsense during the State of the Union that I missed that part.
It just doesn't work just that way. Unbelievable. And then Nancy Pelosi, the look on everybody's face behind him is just like, I'm getting paid to not react to this. And Mike Pence is just looking right at him like, I've got to remember, my communications expert told me to squint. That makes me look like I care.
Just hold the admiration.
That is incidentally what they do tell you. Communications experts tell you that's what Bill Clinton's squint was all about. When you squint, squint at people, I'm looking at you.
That's more of a W squint right there.
Well, they all have their squint. They all have their squint. So you cannot.
We're creating an economy in the 21st century.
If you want to legislate.
That innovation hinges on not investigating Travelgate. Whitewater is impeding AOL's innovation.
Yeah, he's, so awesome. Just if he just started saying like you can't get the returns if you investigate the interns, or I don't know what that would have been.
Your capital return will depreciate with the intern. God.
Just horrible. And the
People laughed at him. It doesn't work that
People laughed at him. I don't know if that was meant to be a laugh line by him, but people laughed at him.
Got a laugh. Can't argue with that.
Well, so at least I got a laugh. What was the other clip?
Well, we got the socialism thing where Bernie doesn't respond, and then the call for, I think, bipartisanship where AOC doesn't respond, that people are gifting a lot.
Okay, yeah. So
AOC and Bernie won in that room.
Here is Trump, I guess, sort of acknowledging that that socialism is ascendant in our society. Like, I mean, when was the last time an American president felt like compelled, even during, you know, even during the Reagan years? Like, I don't think, like, the idea that
domestic socialism was something they had to mobilize against.
Nope. I mean, I think this is a good sign.
Wilson or something.
I just don't think that Trump. I mean, what's fascinating about this is, like, why sort of highlight this? I mean, because I don't think that Trump made a very strong case. I don't think anybody's going like, hey, man, he's right. We got to watch out for this socialism. I just don't think that was what the point of this was.
Here in the United States, we are alarmed by the new calls to adopt socialism in our country. America was founded on liberty and independence, and not government coercion, domination, and control. We are born free, and we will stay free.
There's Bernie.
Not
terribly impressed. And, you know, and the interesting thing is that in his rebuttal, Bernie specifically addressed this and made basically what was, I could only describe as an expansion of FDR's Four Freedoms by saying, you know, we're not free if our wages are stagnant. We're not free if we are beholden to private insurance companies to make sure that we stay healthy. We're not free, et cetera, et cetera, at that point. And so he specifically addressed that moment from Trump, but I thought it was a very, you know, I think that a lot of this for Trump was just like, I've got to hit these basic things. Otherwise, you know, I'm going to lose Sean Hannity tonight. And so that was I think that was the agenda there.
Well, if the bad thing about socialism is authoritarianism, Trump doesn't really have a leg to stand on.
Well, you say that.
I love freedom.
I don't know. I love freedom a lot.
Jamie, let me just say, you can't legislate if you're going to investigate.
You can't legislate if you're going to bring that hate.
You got me there.
Think about it.
I will also say that he did not do, you can't Southern District of New York me if I'm going to prejork me.
I don't know. I'm getting tired. Anyway, MS-13 is around.
Yes. And you can't capture MS-13 if you insist on investigating a mean.
Investigating and being mean.
All right, so AOC crushed something else, and then we're out of here.
Okay, so...
okay, let's go.
It's not even noon, and Michael's
let's try some more of these.
Just pounding the beer.
Let's do some more rhymes.
Yeah, I like that. Can we do more limericks to make fun of Trump? Because I gave you the day off, so I'd like
don't
to keep you
Don't you think
here
that's astonishing,
hours.
Though, that like that actually made it into a State of the Union?
Oh, I think it's awesome.
I think it's great. I would like to see more of that.
No, like Leslie Lee said, it's hard to do comedy about Trump because nothing is funnier than Trump himself.
That's true.
I get to the jokes first.
Punchline.
Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson called. He wants his line back. all right. So here is Donald Trump calling for bipartisanship. And, you know, look, I don't know. Like, we haven't had a chance to sort of like check around at this point. But is there any human being who can say like this was, you know, sincere without being a total liar themselves? Let's listen to this.
But we must reject the politics of revenge, resistance, and retribution, and embrace the boundless potential of cooperation, compromise, and the common good.
Oh.
Pelosi believes it.
Well, no, wait a second. Go back here for a second. Because first off, AOC completely ices him. But
Ice queen.
But notice that Pelosi doesn't just clap. She sticks her hands in his face. Mm-hmm. Watch this. Go back.
No, that's actually a very alpha
aggressive
move she
yeah,
did
look,
there.
Watch it.
Oh, yeah. No, she's like, listen to yourself,
exactly.
Moron.
Clapping in front of your face.
It's like she's in the front row at a Duke game.
Yeah.
She still
no, but he's
in
the other team. That was actually great. And then AOC sat, as did Lydia Vasquez, actually.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, that row. That's a good row there. So it was great. We've got a good interview ahead.
Well, I mean, so it'll be interesting to see if I'm going to make a bet that Donald Trump's approval ratings rise 2 points because of this.
I think that's exactly. And actually, Vox, the headline to me is correct, which is that he is now officially low energy.
Yeah. Well,
It wasn't. It was boring. I mean, even the stuff, because it's like the stuff we're riffing on was actually supposed to be something compelling. Like,
right.
He didn't write that line as a joke.
Slightly irregular mushroom dick energy, you know?
Well, part of it is also not only the mushroom dick energy, but totally predictable.
All right.
Totally indeed. Predictable.
Now to our esteemed
guest. The thing is that he's no, you know, in the context of the State of the Union, and maybe that's just the nature of that speech, but everything that is interesting about Donald Trump is not possible in the context
right.
of that speech.
Yeah.
And
his
which
way
is,
of charisma, mm-hmm. everything he does, it's not possible. And he's still hasn't, you know, every year we're like, will he go off script? Well, nope.
No. Brendan, I'm afraid you lose.
Wow.
I think I might win this bet, guys.
More like a sad
wait, what was
take?
Your bet?
He's not going to pull out his dick that we can see, and all the pundits are going to think he did great.
I don't think.
How are we going to see about the pundits?
Yeah, I don't. I don't think there's going to be.
I think
I'll
we're
put
beyond,
it to you this way. There's
going to.
Yeah,
point.
We're beyond that. There's going to be more energy given to Stacey Abrams than his speech. Regardless,
I think so.
She's even just like the horse race story of the night.
I think that's probably true.
She totally overshadowed.
I think
him.
People are going to be like Stacey Abrams for real. She was the first. She was the first person in years to deliver a State of the Union rebuttal and not hurt herself.
Yeah.
And I think that's a big deal because this is someone who, you know, even her being, I think, you know, running for governor in Georgia is a big deal. But getting propelled to national spotlight, you know, particularly when all you hear about is Beto, this is a big deal, I think. All right. Well, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Corey Brettschneider on his book, The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. We will be back live tomorrow on this program. Just a reminder, you can support this show by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program political professor of politics at Brown University and author of The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents, Corey Brettschneider. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to the discussion.
So, all right, let's start just with the idea of the oath. The relationship mm-hmm. between the oath, because I have to admit that I don't know that I ever talk about or even contemplate the fact that the first thing the president does as the president is to take this oath and what its relationship to the Constitution means. Walk us through that.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, literally the first second in office, it's the first thing the president does is recite a set of words that are prescribed word for word in Article 2, which creates the presidency. And one of the things that it does, too, is prescribe these first few moments. And to me, what part of the significance are the words themselves, but it's also the idea is a symbol, I think, that you're prescribing these first few moments in office. And what it's saying, I think, the Constitution to the president directly is, look, this isn't an anything goes kind of job. This isn't you won the election, you were elected by the majority, do what you want. There's a set of duties that come with it, a set of obligations to respect, and limits as well on the office. So I think that there's a sort of deep symbol in the fact that that office has these prescribed words. And then, of course, in the content, to me, the most significant part of the oath is the requirement that a president commit to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, which is about most obviously not violating it, but also going beyond that to try to really, even if the courts, for instance, aren't going to require you to respect certain requirements of freedom of religion or the ban on establishment, there are things that as president you've independently committed to do. So the book is partly about the role of courts in stopping a president that does wrong and disregards basic rights, but it's also about the independent obligations of the office. And that's something that we have to start to look for as voters, I think, when we elect a president. And I think a lot of people haven't really thought about the oath. And, you know, when you're in a crisis like the one that we're in now with this president who is such the antithesis of the kind of president that the framers imagined, it just refocuses us, I think, on the basics and the basic requirements of the office, and that preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution is what I'm trying to get people to see as the focus of the presidency, and to return to the way that actually when we elect a president, to see that as part of what we're looking for.
I mean, there's a tension there, though, right? Particularly mm-hmm. with, I mean, there's obviously a tension with the constraints that the Constitution places on the president as mm-hmm. interpreted and enforced by the courts, right? And then also mm-hmm. By Congress. But there's also a tension between the sort of the proactive obligation of a president to protect and preserve the Constitution when the president doesn't have the ability to, or doesn't have, I guess, the power, theoretically, to say what the Constitution says.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's one sort of view, and I think it's a view that the courts have sometimes, this Supreme Court, for instance, has sometimes expressed that, you know, it's the role of the courts to say what the Constitution is, and these other branches do other things. But I'm what sometimes people call departmentalist. It's a sort of view that goes back to Jefferson that says, you know, the Constitution is an independent set of words, first of all, and second of all, set of values, I think, that are independent of any one institution. And if that's right, that the Constitution stands as an independent thing, it means that any branch can interpret it. Really, any person, any citizen, you and I can do it just as well, I think, in many ways, better than the current Supreme Court. And so, yeah, I don't think it's just the role of courts to do this thing of interpretation. And I think that's sort of, you know, part of the problem that we've gotten away from, that, you know, it would be a real travesty, especially given this Supreme Court, if we said, you know what, the courts failed to enforce the travel ban, and that's the end of the story. I mean, to me, that was a real failing, not just a moral failing, but a failing of constitutional interpretation. And the fact that they failed, the court failed to stop a president from doing so, doesn't mean that there wasn't an independent obligation of a president to not basically seek a ban based on religion, the most obvious violation of the First Amendment guarantee of free exercise of religion that there could be, and the ban on establishment of religion, the ban on specifically not favoring one religion over another. And even in that travel ban decision, which I was so disappointed in, Justice Kennedy comes right out in this sort of wishy-washy opinion. You know, he fails to do the right thing. But he does say something like, look, just because we failed to stop a president, it doesn't mean that he hasn't violated the Constitution or his sort of independent role. So I want to get away from the idea that this is just a document for lawyers and just a document, especially for the Supreme Court. It's for all of the branches. And even more fundamentally, for me, the Constitution is a document for citizens that we all need to start to pay attention to, because, you know, there is no Constitution police. The court, especially this Supreme Court with this current makeup, can't be trusted to really guarantee the basic values, the rights that have been so hard earned over centuries, and including, you know, a war in the 19th century. And so if we can't trust this one institution, it falls upon the other institutions to do it. The presidency, of course, is not a place where we're going to find a defense of the Constitution right now, but it can be in the future. And that's part of what I'm trying to do, is to get people to see the next election as about a constitutional office and a referendum on the constitutional obligations of a president.
Well, walk us through how a president would do that, but also how the rest of us would do that when the Constitution is, and maybe to, before we do that, we should preface just with your perspective on the Constitution. I mean, there's, you know, broadly speaking, two, very generally speaking, two sort of like, I guess, broad assessments or perspectives on the Constitution as a living document, and others who perceive it as something that was written and it's static, and we need to divine what was what it meant the moment.
Yeah, Scalia used to call it a dead document.
Right, exactly. Like when the ink dried on the paper, that was the end of the story. And it's just, I guess, you know, which among us are smart enough to know exactly what was meant by it when that ink dried. So, but where, give us a sense of those two different perspectives and how that implicates, how that plays into this relationship of the president saying, like, okay, the Supreme Court is not assessing the Constitution properly or upholding it. I'm going to step in. I mean, how does that work?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the first thing is we have to battle that out. I mean, I take a stand in the book against the view that's usually called originalism that you describe, the Scalia view, that the Constitution should be understood in the way that it would have been understood at the time that it was ratified or enacted. And so that means the 18th century if you're talking about the original Constitution, or the mid-19th century if you're talking about the Civil Rights amendments, for instance. And on my view, you know, that really fails to capture the meaning of the terms when you start to read them. So when the Eighth Amendment says, when it bans cruel and unusual punishment, I don't think that cruel can just mean, you know, what people commonly thought in the 18th century cruel was. So if flogging wasn't thought to be cruel, then that's fine. I think that what they did, what the words do, is they sort of invite us to, first of all, you know, read their plain meaning, and sometimes they're plain, like the age of the president is very clear, for instance. You know, there's not a lot of debate about that. Sometimes the text is clear, and sometimes it invites us to go beyond the text and to engage in really a sort of value-based, as I call it, or moral reflection on the meaning of the words. And we don't just do that free form. We do that partly by looking to the principles of as they've evolved over time, to the case law. So while the Supreme Court doesn't have the final word and it can get things wrong, I think it also informs us through the history and through the cases. So in the book, what I'm trying to do is, you know, I don't call it a living view because it starts from the text, but it also goes beyond it by looking to the values as they've been understood over time through the case law, and also through direct sort of common sense and through the history of the principles that we're talking about. So for me, you know, you just have to read the text and talk about the specifics of the text. So, you know, cruel and unusual punishment might not have been widely thought in the 18th century to ban the death penalty. But when the court in Furman versus Georgia said, you know, the deep value of the ban on cruelty is incompatible with essentially the torture that's involved in capital punishment. Or the current Supreme Court failed to recognize that, you know, when you make a law based on intentional prejudice, based on religion, that to me, that's the most obvious violation of those two religion clauses, the guarantee of free exercise of religion and the ban on favoring religion or the ban on establishment. So I think you go clause by clause, and you partly look at the words, and you can start with that, but then you also engage in, you know, a broad value-based kind of inquiry in the way that the framers themselves did, that courts do, and that you and I are doing right now just in having this conversation.
Okay, so I become president, and I'm an originalist or a textualist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I say, I'm trying to play this part well, but I'm deeply skeptical.
Right.
I'm deeply skeptical, right, frankly, that we had an agreement when we wrote this back in the day as to, even amongst ourselves, about how cruel we thought flogging was, which I think is problematic.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But nevertheless, I'm a president, and so I interpret it this way. And why do I get to interpret the Constitution? I mean, so it's one thing for me to say, like, I'm going to protect and serve the Constitution. But I got news for you. I think it says something different than you do. What is the mechanism to, if not adjudicate this, to resolve it?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I should say that if we're in that realm of originalism versus my way of thinking, we're a million times ahead of where we are right now, because this president, I don't think, has any kind of view of the Constitution. And there are sort of common agreements as you sort of go through the book about the limits on the presidency, about the meaning of the Bill of Rights, that are just so obviously disregarded in the various proposals that Trump's made during the campaign and more recently. So even that would be light years ahead of where we are. But I think the ultimate answer to your challenge, if we have an originalist president, is to say, look, there is, that's just a basic fact of American life right now, that there's a battle going on. It's basically a 5-4 battle on the Supreme Court itself, between two visions of the Constitution. And this has been true throughout history. We've had different visions of the Constitution. And what progressives need to do is to define theirs. And so I think, you know, when I give my account of why the Muslim ban is a violation of the religion clauses, or why the death penalty really does violate the cruel and unusual clause, that's not just, you know, some words that I'm using. It's a vision of the Constitution that is at odds with an originalist president. So what do you do? I mean, well, that's what elections, I think, should be about, is battling over these two visions. Now, this isn't new. I mean, in the 19th century, before the Civil War, there were two visions of the Constitution. One said that African Americans weren't people. That was the view of Dred Scott. And the other was Frederick Douglass's view, which was the Constitution is a set of values, and what it means to respect it is to take seriously the idea of equality and self-evident truths and liberty, and to as he put it, that the sort of glorious liberty talked about in the Constitution can't truly be meaningful unless it's expanded to everyone. Now, those were two visions too of the Constitution, but one, in my view, was the now recognized rightly as the right one. That happened during the New Deal, where there were people, and they're back now, frankly, who thought, you know, minimum wage laws were a violation of liberty. And then there were people like FDR.
Child labor laws.
Yeah, it was the Dagenhart case, striking down child labor laws. And there were others, progressives said at the time, that, you know, you're wrong. Basically, that's not the meaning of the document. So there isn't a sort of easy answer to the question of who's the ultimate adjudicator, because I think really in the end it's about a battle amongst the electorate, amongst the people, amongst politicians for different visions of what the Constitution is, and that's the story of American history.
So, I mean, is that for you, like, the is that the primary value of the Constitution, not what is written per se and not what is interpreted per se, but rather a dynamic that is grounded in or around the Constitution?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good way to put it. I guess the way I would put it is that I agree with the originalists that the text is a starting point. Sometimes, like in that age requirement for the president or for representatives or senators, it's the beginning and the end. But in a lot of these issues, the most important ones that we're really battling about, abortion, religious freedom, free speech, it's the beginning, and it's an invitation to a kind of dialogue. And it's a dialogue that's partly embedded in the past and in past decisions, but ultimately it is about, you know, what it means to carry those values into the future. And, you know, I guess this way of talking is less certain than the originalist way of talking, but I think it's much more honest to what's going on when a court decides a case. I mean, when Roe was decided, or, you know, we could take any landmark case, or Brown versus Board, which is sort of settled, you know, people disagreed. Like, there was a case, let's take Brown, for instance, Plessy versus Ferguson, that said segregation is completely compatible with the idea of equal protection of laws, you know, famously, because, as long as the facilities are the same and are basically equal. And what Brown was about was a principled rejection of that view, and it said very clearly that separate is inherently unequal. Now, that's not something that, you know, inherently unequal isn't found in the words of the 14th Amendment. It's an idea that the court's carrying forth. And it didn't have authority just because they said it. It had authority, I think, because it gave a kind of, I mean, I guess I'd say a vision of what American democracy is really about. I mean, it would sort of define the core ethos of the country. And so that's what I'm trying to do throughout the book as we go through the various powers, talking about war, talking about the Bill of Rights, talking ultimately about what you do with a president like this one who's gone rogue and is at odds with the Constitution, is to, you know, I can't just say, here's what the words say, full stop, that's the end of the story. It has to be a kind of conversation about the values that are involved. So, you know, when it comes to questions that we're talking about today, for instance, Nancy Pelosi's talking about the idea that I defend in the book, which is, although a lot of scholars say president can't be indicted while in office,
right.
I say, you know, the president's not above the law. And that's an idea that you find in the U.S. v. Nixon case. It's what you find throughout the Constitution when there are limits on what the president can do. And in the oath itself, the idea that, you know, a president is devoted to the law rather than him or herself.
Let me just put a pin in that just for a minute.
Sure.
And it's one of, I want to get to. But before we get there, I want to sort of stay just one more question in this sort of like, I guess, concept.
Right.
Is it in your mind worse to have a guy like Donald Trump who clearly, I mean, I don't think, I don't want to get into the prediction game, but if I was to bet a lot of money, if I was forced to bet my kids' college education savings on whether Donald Trump has read the entire Constitution or not, I would bet not.
Yes, he did not get through it, I'm pretty sure.
Is it more problematic to have someone like that, or someone who is manipulating the way the Constitution works? What is more problematic there? Because, you know, prior to Trump, I mean, in many respects, between Bush and Obama and Trump, I think we saw three different versions of how not so great things can happen relative to the Constitution. Mm. The Bush administration had a very unique theory about the power of the presidency relative to the Constitution, and went rogue, I think, in many people's respects. Obama came in and in many respects codified. Rather than say this stuff is outside the bounds of what the Constitution allows and American law allows, tried to bring it into a system and sometimes had to sort of like, you know, stretch the box a little bit, but wanted it to be codified because he had the same inclination, I think, that, you know, many law professors would have, is that like we need a rationale for this rather than... because if we don't have a rationale, then I get to lock them up.
But otherwise,
we can put it into some type of system. And then Donald Trump comes in and it's completely willy-nilly. It's like a monkey playing chess type of situation.
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I'll just give you a quick answer and then sort of build up your point. I mean, I do think he is by far the worst, and that the sort of ignorance of the Constitution combined with the disposition that is really not just against the words of the Constitution, but really its core values, especially the idea of equality or the basic ideas of freedom. That's the most dangerous thing, I think, that we've seen, period, in the history of the country. But that said, there have been, and in the book I'm critical of presidents in the past who have certainly been, well-versed in the Constitution. So take Woodrow Wilson, who was probably one of the greatest constitutional scholars, certainly of his time, and was president, and used the office in a lot of ways because of his confidence in a way that was at odds with the basic ideas of the Constitution. So, you know, he not only is quoted at length in Birth of a Nation, the film about celebrating the Ku Klux Klan, but he views it in the White House. And, you know, he sort of does it with a confidence that this is somehow compatible with the Equal Protection Clause. I think he must have known better, but it was something about the confidence, I think, of how much he felt he knew the document, that he felt empowered to do this sort of thing. With Obama, for instance, and the failure to seek a resolution in Libya, that's another example, certainly, of a law professor, somebody who I think was in many ways a great president, but really went wrong when it came to the abuse of the war powers. That confidence, I think, came partly from his deep knowledge of the document and of the debates. But what you get with Trump is just of a different order of magnitude, because I think he's on really every dimension of the Constitution, his instincts are contrary. So, I mean, think of the threat to lock up and imprison your political opponent. I mean, nothing could be more at odds with the idea of free speech in the First Amendment. It's sort of the core meaning of it is not to do that. Or the proposal to torture the families of suspected terrorists, not just the terrorists themselves, of obvious violation of due process, and not to mention cruel and unusual punishment. We could keep going through them. The travel ban gets fixed by the lawyers eventually, but he keeps saying, and certainly in the beginning, no, I want a Muslim ban. Anybody who knows anything about the Constitution wouldn't do that, and those kind of combination, I think, of these things amount to somebody who doesn't get the basics of the rule of law, who is an aspirational fascist dictator. He hasn't achieved that, but I think that's what he envisions himself. So, you know, I take it very seriously when he praises the dictator of North Korea. It's part and parcel of the idea that he has no knowledge of, and I completely agree with you, of the basics of our system. He said at one point early, you know, in the campaign that he was talking about his sister, who is a judge on one of the federal circuit courts, you know, high level judge. She at one point said that the partial birth abortion ban was unconstitutional, that it violated Roe versus Wade. And he said, I don't know why my sister signed that bill. And it's right. Like the most basic understanding of Schoolhouse Rock. But it's more than that. It's also the disposition to kind of be against the rule of law. That's what I think really does make him the worst president.
Right. It's not that he doesn't have an understanding of the Constitution specifically. It's that he doesn't even recognize the concept of the rule of law.
And even more than that, it's certainly that. It's that his instincts are contrary to the idea that we're bound by law, or that we're bound by basic liberty of free speech. Or, I mean, the bigotry, too. I mean, the Equal Protection Clause is really about the idea that you can't make laws based on prejudice, full stop. And the sort of modern doctrine of the Supreme Court is that, you know, your intent matters. And if you're making a law or an executive order based on prejudice, that's unconstitutional. Now, in the travel ban case, there's an exception that the court basically finds when people are outside the boundaries of the United States. That's what they relied on. But certainly any internal policy with that kind of motivation would be unconstitutional.
That's what they found. I mean, or it was a very narrow decision, but in the
very narrow. RFRA,
in the RFRA, I'm talking about that RFRA one with the Colorado Baker, was that that there was instance in the questioning of this Colorado Baker that expressed some type of hostility to religion, which I think was dubious, but nevertheless. Right. All right. Well, so let's get to
this. I was
going to
say just a quick point on that, because it is so relevant. I had a piece when Kennedy retired just talking about the deep contradiction between finding animus towards this Baker in the Cake case, and the so much more obvious example of religious animus in the travel ban case. Right. I thought that really marred his legacy. What otherwise would have been one of our great justices really, really ruined, I think, his reputation, because it's such a flagrant contradiction.
I think I can come up with a couple others too. The idea of there is no appearance of bribery when it comes to in Citizens United. Sticks in my craw a bit, but there may be one or two others. But let's not digress here. Let me ask you just in this, in terms of the DOJ has found their interpretation of the Constitution is a sitting president can't be indicted. Does that mean that he's above the law? Like, isn't the issue that there is a different mechanism to punish a president or to find a president guilty of the law of a breach of the law that isn't? I mean, rather than he can't be indicted means he's above the law, isn't it just simply like we have a different mechanism, a special mechanism for adjudicating this, and that's called impeachment and conviction in the Senate?
Yeah, I think that captures the debate really well. And this is one of those instances where the text isn't going to, answer it. And certainly we're not going to get agreement from the framers. Hamilton made exactly the argument that you're making. He said, look, it's not that the president isn't above the law. It's that there are two separate processes and impeachment has to come first. And by the way, the president can be indicted after he or she is removed through that distinct process. And what the memos do is they try to draw on that, and these are memos, I should say, written by the Department of Justice, Office of Legal Counsel during the Nixon administration, and then another one during Clinton. And incidentally, just tying back to that earlier great question that you were asking, the existence of the Office of Legal Counsel is sort of a recognition of the duty that I'm talking about.
Right.
What that office does is its sole function is to take all of the actions of a president and to hold them against the Constitution and to say what's constitutional and what's not. And they're supposed to tell the president basically, sorry, you can't do that. Hopefully there's in the future, they're going to play an active role in stopping this president more than they have. But on the indictment question, what the memos say is they sort of start from that Hamilton point, the point that you're making, and then they make two other points. They say, look, a president is unique in his or her role. That's why there has to be a separate justice process. Because if the president is basically, the entire executive branch is going to stop functioning. That it's that important a job. It's the sole person that runs a branch that's got, now more than 2.5 million people. And then the other argument is that there's a kind of dignity to the office that immunizes the president from the legal process. So that's what the memos say. They sort of build that argument up, and certainly they don't think that they're saying that a president is above the law. They're just saying that it's a sort of unique position. But I think it's just wrong. And when you start going through all of those arguments, you see why. And here we're helped not just by thinking about that idea of the rule of law, but also the cases. On the too busy argument, I mean, first of all, with this president, I think it might be a good thing if he was distracted.
Right.
But they also work things out with courts. It's not that, the court basically demands you be there without any sort of coordination. And if you think of the enormous coordination that's going on all the time, the executive branch moving the nuclear suitcase around the world, for instance, it's possible to work it out with courts in a way that I think, could accommodate the president.
To me, it seems like the most compelling argument is simply you wouldn't want the law to be used as a weapon in this way. I mean, that you wouldn't want it to be weaponized as a political weapon. And if you were, you should make it an explicitly political, or I should say, and the only way to prevent that from happening is to make it an explicitly political thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think removal is rightly exactly that. And when we could talk about impeachment,
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. That's why I'm saying impeachment as opposed to indictment.
Right.
I mean, frankly,
have that.
I have an issue with a lot of the work that Robert Mueller has done, in a lot of his career, frankly. With James Comey. And these guys, you know, I think at times we're tasked or we're undertaking inappropriate things, particularly when it comes to like Muslim surveillance back in the aughts and whatnot. And so, you know, maybe I don't want them to have the ability to bring an indictment against the president because I just don't trust them that much.
Well, and Ken Starr is your best example, I think. That really was a sort of rogue prosecutor that was, in the end, didn't indict, but talked about why you should be able to. So I guess to me, you know, I don't want to discount that. There's a danger of political, you know, prosecutions. And that is, I think, largely what happened during the Starr period. And that's why the independent counsel law, which, you know, basically protects Starr, couldn't have been fired, unlike Mueller. By the DOJ, he had independent protection, and because of the rogueness of that whole operation, I guess you could call it, that law expired. But I guess here's my simple way of putting it. I mean, it's sort of a spin on the kind of classic legal principle. I mean, I would rather have 10 Ken Starrs than one Donald Trump going free. And my worry is that if you don't have basic legal investigation of, you know, collusion with Russia, of the sort of use of the business in order to make money, the sort of, you know, it's really sort of very close to rampant bribery, that the president is such a powerful office, and we're really seeing this now, and the danger of what can be done with it, with the control over the vast federal bureaucracy, with the control over nuclear weapons, with the control over, you know, really an access to the world's financial network, is you know, imagine somebody smarter than Trump. Imagine a sort of And so that's why I think we need the check. I think and if we don't have it, impeachment might not work.
I think investigation is important. I'm skeptical of the indictment. And I'm also, and to be totally honest, like, I'm not convinced that Ken Starr didn't bring us, in many respects, Donald Trump. It's not a hard thing to draw a line between that 7-year multi-million dollar investigation into basically both those Clintons to Donald Trump's election. A lot of the same people were involved, frankly. I mean, this enterprise started the careers of a lot of people, but
And I don't want to downplay the danger. I guess I think, you know, the problem with impeachment, though, although, you know, we'll see what happens when we have a new Congress, of course, but is that, you know, Hamilton sort of just assumed the following thing. And, you know, I could see why. It's common sense. Look, if it turns out the president has committed a crime, you don't need a prosecution because the House is going to immediately impeach and the Senate's going to try and the person will be gone quickly. And I think the problem with Trump, what we've seen over the last 2 years, is that actually it was just a flawed assumption, because it could be the case that a president is both a criminal and extremely popular, or popular enough that the impeachment and removal will never happen. So even now, if the House moves forward with impeachment, as you know, there probably aren't the votes in the Senate for removal.
Oh, definitely. Yes, I think that's a problem.
There's no indictment and there's no impeachment. That means he gets away with
it. I think that's a problem with an entire political party. That is not Trump's problem. That is the Republican Party's problem, it seems to me. But all right, well, let's won't resolve that one. But lastly, let me just ask you this, broadly speaking, as a constitutional scholar. Is the Constitution, like, good? I mean, if you had to take another whack at it, and maybe this question is sort of irrelevant based upon this notion that, like, it's more important to be engaged with it than actually what it says. But if you could take another whack at it as written, there would be big chunks, I would assume, that you would say, like, this didn't work out.
Yeah, well, the whole Senate thing, I might rethink, and the Electoral College, for instance.
Right.
But I also think that there are huge chunks that are saving us right now. So, you know, I do think that the First Amendment guarantee of free speech, internally, I think he's hearing this from his own people and from his Office of Legal Counsel. But I do believe that even this Supreme Court, as bad as it is, if he were to try to carry out, you know, his change to the libel laws, his desire to, I guess, prosecute Saturday Night Live for its libel of this, his greatness, that, you know, those basic protections of freedom and liberty, I think, you know, certainly are there in the document, and I think would operate in the way that they're supposed to. And I think that's true despite what happened, the travel ban in case of religious freedom and equal protection too. And more than that too, the structure, you know, as much as I think that there, you know, is a problem with the Electoral College, the idea that there are co-equal branches, I think, is also a thing that when you have a demagogue like this who's succeeded in being elected, starts to kick in. So, you know, thankfully, we now have the at least one house, that the House of Representatives has gone into the hands of much more sane people. And they'll have investigatory power. They'll have, you know, the ability to look into many of the questions that we're talking about in a way that, that no one has before. I don't know that they'll succeed in removing the president, you know, through the impeachment process, but it is a check. And all of those things are by design. They're all, I think, about the possibility that, you know, they wanted to get away, certainly, from the weakness of the Articles of Confederation, but the framing document was also about the worry that we would have a demagogue come to power, and that the thing is designed to protect liberty and to protect the rule of law from such a person. And, you know, I'm glad about that, because we really are in a situation where we need it right now.
Corey Brettschneider, the book is The Oath and the Office, A Guide to the Constitution for Future Presidents. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam. Really happy to do your show.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bar. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Shifted in.